we've covered most of the particulars of meiosis already, but now in slide 7 we finally get a picture similar to one that we looked at for mitosis that shows you what's happening in each of the subphases. And remember that meiosis has two overall division events, so there's meiosis 1 and meiosis 2, but each of those major divisions has the same subphases as mitosis, even though pro-metaphase isn't shown here because there's nothing really different about what's happening in it compared to mitosis. But before we get into the particulars of these, let me say something that we haven't talked about yet regarding meiosis. We have talked about the whole reason for meiosis. Why does meiosis have to exist? Right, to cut the ploidy in half in order to undo the doubling of the ploidy that fertilization does. And that way you don't accumulate DNA over the generations, which would kill the species. So that's why it has to exist. But this happens in sexual species, and sex, which we've talked about before, as far as the advantages of it, advantage of sex is that it drastically increases genetic variation, and that's why offspring produced sexually have a chance. At least one of them might be better off as far as fitness with the environment than the parents were. Well, there's three major ways in which the genetic variation is amplified because of sex. And two of those occur, I mean, two of those things that are the reasons occur in meiosis, and specifically meiosis one. But let me just give you the three sources of additional variation, genetic variation that sex provides. One is what's called crossing over. This is in the order in which they occur. Crossing over is first. Next is independent assortment. Those are the two that occur actually in meiosis. And then the third is random fertilization. Now, before I actually talk about these, let me say that sex wouldn't accomplish anything as far as genetic variation is concerned. It wouldn't change, it wouldn't. The only reason that sex is able to increase the amount of genetic variation is because genetic variation exists to begin with. What I mean by this is that sex more or less shuffles the deck, genetically speaking. And the only way that shuffling makes any difference is if you have different cards, right? If you have a deck of nothing but three of spades, shuffling isn't going to do anything. You're going to draw a three of spades no matter how many times you shuffle it, right? On the other hand, if you have different cards, then shuffling does randomize things. What I'm trying to say is that by analogy with this card thing, if there weren't already different versions of DNA, then sex wouldn't do anything because sex combines some DNA from each of two parents, right? Well, if they are genetically identical because there's no genetic variation to begin with, then it wouldn't matter. You would still end up with the same version of DNA by combining DNA from identical parents, right? So the only reason sex works is because there is genetic variation to begin with. And what is the original source of all genetic variation? Why is it that there are different versions of DNA in nature? In other words, why is it that we are not simply genetically identical copies of the original successful cells that we all have as ancestors? Why? Well, that's how DNA is replicated, but that's kind of getting to the answer. The original source of all genetic variation is mutation. Mutation is just any change in genetic sequence, right? Just accidentally. Whether it's caused by something in nature like ultraviolet light or some chemical, or whether it's just an accident in the replication process, mutation is what produces genetic variation. And then once that genetic variation is in a population, sex matters at that point, because then the parents are not genetically identical, and when you take some DNA from each of the two parents, you're making something that hasn't existed before, some new combination of DNA. And that's done in these three ways: crossing over, independent assortment, and random fertilization. I'll define these as we get to them, but this is the order in which they occur. The first two happen in just one parent, well, the other parent as well. But before the parents engage in fertilization, all right, this is just, these first two happen in just the meiosis process that in diploid organisms produce the gametes. Let's look at the particulars, though, of meiosis, starting with meiosis one, and just like the overall subdivisions are called one and two, you can call the subphases with one or two. So prophase one is just another name for prophase of meiosis one. Right away, we have something that's starkly different from prophase of mitosis. First, though, by looking at this first cell, it's the cell in the first stage, the leftmost cell. By looking at that, what is the N? No. What does N mean? The types of what? Types is right, but the types by itself is not enough. Types of what? Yes. How many different types of chromosomes there are in a species is N in general. It's a variable because the number of types varies with species. But for this species, whatever it is, N is what? How many types of chromosomes are here? Three. Big, medium, and small. Right? And what's the ploidy?
Two.
We don't use numbers for ploidy. We use words. It's a diploid cell. This cell is diploid, right? Because there are two of each of those three kind. There's a red one and a blue one that's large. There's a red one and a blue one that's medium, and so on. Okay? Everyone reacquainted with those terms? N and ploidy? Okay. Well, speaking of ploidy, it would not make sense for a haploid cell to enter meiosis. Meiosis cuts the ploidy in half. If you're haploid, you already have only one of each kind of chromosome. So a haploid cell can't enter meiosis. On the other hand, mitosis doesn't change the ploidy. And so a cell of any ploidy can enter mitosis, and it just produces two cells of that same ploidy. Okay? Because mitosis just makes genetic copies of the original cell. All right. Well, anyway, this is an N of three. It's a diploid cell entering meiosis. And in prophase one, we have something that does not happen in prophase of mitosis. Namely, the homologs find each other and come together. The homologs are the two chromosomes that correspond to each other. They're the two of the same type, right? So the two big ones find each other and come together. The two medium ones find each other and come together. And so on for however many, for N types. In this case, three. But if this were a human diploid cell, there would be 23 pairs coming together. We don't even use the word homologous in mitosis because the two number ones don't care where they each other is. All right? That coming together of the homologs is called synapsis. Syn means together. But not only do they find each other and come together, but when they do, they cross over. That's that first of the three sources of additional genetic variation I was talking about. In crossing over, you'll get a better picture of this in a different slide, but let me quickly draw what I mean. Okay, synapsis would be, I'm going to use red and purple. Well, purple's probably going to look too similar. Let me use green. Or black. These are homologous chromosomes, right? Well, let me use a black that works. That's probably why that was over there. So they're the same type of chromosome. They come together. But these haven't crossed over. What I mean by crossing over is that one of the chromatids of one homolog crosses over with one of the chromatids of the other, you know, they physically cross each other, but more than just crossing, they, from that point onward to the tip, they swap their piece of DNA. So this little red piece here is now part of this mostly black homolog. And this little black piece right here is part of this mostly red homolog because they've swapped. The point at which the crossing over is, where the two actually cross, is called a chiasma. That's the singular word. Chi is a Greek letter that looks like an X to us. It crosses. A chiasma is singular. The plural is chiasmata, as shown in here, which the fact that there's a plural means that crossing over doesn't have to happen just once. It can happen twice, as you see, for the same homologous pair, or not at all. It's basically random. But anyway, the crossover point for each crossing over event is called a chiasma, and at that point onward, there is a swapping of the material. That means right away, just simply because of this crossing over, there is now a chromosome that has never existed, because that particular sequence of DNA isn't like either of the two parents. You see that? It's partly one parent and partly the other, but it's a new sequence now that's a combination of the two. And that's why it's one of the sources of additional genetic variation. But think back to what I said earlier. If there weren't genetic variation to begin with, then what you would be crossing over would be identical pieces of DNA, and if you swap them, nothing changes. You have to have different versions of DNA due to mutation first before sex makes any difference. Now, keep in mind what a chromosome is. Well, just the DNA component. Ignore the histone proteins. But within one chromosome, there's an enormously long double-stranded DNA, which is millions of nucleotides long. OK? contains thousands of genes but millions of nucleotides. And crossing over can occur anywhere along that length, almost anywhere. So think of the number of possible ways that you could cross over. Not only just for one chromosome, which is an enormous number by itself, but then you have to multiply that, or you have to compound that by the fact that there's however many chromosomes in the species. For humans, there's 23 pairs that are crossing over. So when you do the math, the number of possible new combinations of DNA just due to crossing over, ignoring these other sources that we'll talk about more in a second, just that number is effectively infinite. It's so huge. It's like it rivals the number of atoms in the universe. It's so big. And that's why even if we lived for thousands of years, a human male, for instance, once we start making sperm at puberty, we make millions of sperm every day, and we do that for however many years. Even if we lived thousands of years and produced millions every day, the chance that we would produce two identical sperm in a lifetime is effectively zero, since there are so many possible ways to cross over. So that is not only one of the three sources of additional genetic variation that sex gives us, but it is by far numerically the biggest, the richest source of additional variation. Okay, synapsis and crossing over occur in prophase one. That's the big deal of prophase one. In metaphase one, since it's called metaphase, you should be used to the fact that something's lining up, right? But we discussed earlier that what lines up in metaphase one of meiosis is different from what lines up in metaphase of mitosis. What is it, by the way, that lines up in metaphase of mitosis? Well, that's slightly better. Well, no, the sister chromatids are part of the replicated chromosomes. What did you say?
The homologous pairs?
No. I'm glad you said that, even though it's completely wrong, because that's important to realize that it's not homologous pairs. We're talking about mitosis.
Oh.
In mitosis, we don't even use the word homologous pairs because, like I said, the homologs are not interested in each other. They don't find each other. So the correct answer for what lines up in metaphase of mitosis is individual replicated chromosomes. Not pairs, not homologous pairs, but individual. Right? So for an N of 3, as we see here, there would be 6 things lining up, each individual replicated chromosome. For a human diploid cell, in mitosis, there would be 46 things lining up. Okay? So, in general, for a diploid cell, 2N things line up in metaphase of mitosis. Well, in meiosis, that's not the case. Since the homologs synapse in prophase, that's what lines up. Not individual chromosomes, but pairs of chromosomes, homologous pairs of chromosomes. And therefore, it's N different things that line up, not 2N. Here we have 3, which is what N is for this example, pairs of chromosomes lining up, not 6 individual replicated chromosomes. And by the way, a homologous pair is an acceptable phrase, although a homologous pair doesn't necessarily mean that they've come together. It just describes their relationship. When synapsis occurs, we can use different names for a homologous pair. A homologous pair that has synapsed can be called either a tetrad or a bivalent. Those are interchangeable words. But notice that tetrad really means a four-piece thing, even though there are two chromosomes involved. It's a pair of chromosomes, but we call it a tetrad because it's a pair of replicated chromosomes. So if you count the number of overall chromatids involved, it's four of them, right? Two sister chromatids on one homolog, two sister chromatids on the other homolog. So that's what a tetrad is. A tetrad in this cartoon version is this whole thing, partly red and partly blue. And it's the tetrads that line up at metaphase one, yeah.
So if you have something that has a ploidy created to, is that a tetroid, is that what it's called?
It would be a tetraploid cell if it has four, yes.
So if you have one of those, is this process the same?
More or less, although it, you would still split just into two. For instance, if you were tetraploid.
What I mean is, like, are they going to be like paired up? Like, can they do the crossing over the same? Like,
yes. Right. Yes. And there are, I'm sure that there are, molecularly speaking, subtle differences. This happens a lot in plants, by the way, for some reason. Animals don't tolerate polyploidy, as it's called, anything greater than diploid, very well. It causes problems in animals, but plants have dealt with it well, and there's a lot of polyploidy in plants, actually, for whatever reason. That's a good question. I just don't know enough about the specifics of tetraploid and above. And you can actually have triploid, which is, you know, three of them instead of four. But in this course, we'll stick to diploid and haploid, which are the two main types of ploidy. But a tetrad is a synapsed homologous pair, and that's what lines up in my metaphase of meiosis one. Tetrads, N tetrads. In this case, three tetrads. 23 pairs would be lining up in a human. Since what lines up in metaphase one is different from what lines up in metaphase of mitosis, therefore what splits in anaphase one of meiosis is different from what splits in anaphase of mitosis. So let's quickly recall what splits in anaphase of mitosis. What splits apart? The sister chromatids that make up a replicated chromosome split apart. And that's when they stop being called sister chromatids, right? They are then unreplicated daughter chromosomes in their own right. That's not what's happening here, because it's not individual replicated chromosomes that line up. It's tetrads, and it's the tetrads that split. It's the two homologs that separate from each other in each tetrad. All right, so the blue or mostly blue one is going to go in toward one pole. The red or mostly red one is going to go toward the other pole.
So, mitosis for metaphase, it's at the sojourner that they're separating. And in metaphase one for meiosis, it's the crossing over that's separating.
It's, well, the crossing over is the process of them swapping. And that occurs in the previous stage, prophase. So crossing over is already done here. They're still synapsed, but that relationship, that synaptic relationship, is what is disintegrated, and is what is eliminated, and these two homologs now go their own way toward different poles, and they'll end up in different cells. And this, by the way, is why, importantly, anaphase reduces the ploidy. Because one homolog is going to go to one cell, another homolog is going to go to the other cell, and neither cell is going to have both versions anymore, right? Both of those cells are going to be haploid, because both of those cells are going to have just one of each of the three types, three for this example. You see that? You see why that reduces the ploidy? Because the homologs are no longer both there in the cell. Or they won't once the cytokinesis happens. But in mitosis, it's just the chromatids that split apart. So each of the two daughter cells that's produced by mitosis still has the same number of each type. They're just unreplicated instead of being replicated. All right, we'll see a good picture of that in a minute. But that's anaphase, and then there's cytokinesis that happens so that you have two official cells after meiosis one. Those cells are already haploid, though. Notice these cartoons. Each one has only one of each of the three types. So haploidy already has been accomplished. And that's the overall goal of meiosis, right? To cut the ploidy in half. That's already occurred. So why are we not done at this point? When the goal, so to speak, has already been reached? Right, these are still replicated chromosomes. Yes, the cells are haploid, but they still have replicated chromosomes, just like a cell that enters mitosis. And therefore, you need something to do just what mitosis does, which is to split the chromatids apart. So meiosis II is just like mitosis, really, for each of the two cells that meiosis I produces. Right, they're already haploid, but they have replicated chromosomes, so it's now individual replicated chromosomes that line up and chromatids that split in anaphase II. And once you have cytokinesis happen in both of those cells, you now have four cells, all of which are haploid, and all of which are genetically distinct. Okay, one of the reasons they're genetically different from each other, the four cells, is because of crossing over, as I said. But independent assortment happened in meiosis one as well. I just didn't mention it when we were getting through these stages. So let me define what that is. Well, first of all, just the assortment word in that phrase, assortment by itself, refers to how a tetrad lines up at the metaphase plate. First of all, consider mitosis. You have a replicated chromosome consisting of two identical sister chromatids, right? And so when a replicated chromosome in mitosis lines up in the metaphase plate, it doesn't matter which way it is in terms of upside down or right side up, because those two chromatids are identical. When they separate and go their own ways, each pole is going to receive an identical copy. You following what I'm saying here? On the other hand, a tetrad is not two identical halves. A tetrad is mostly blue on one and mostly red on the other. So how it, the tetrad, assorts matters. It can be either, in this case, the poles are top and bottom. So it could be either blue up and red down, or red up and blue down. But those are different from each other because the two homologs are not genetically identical. Okay? That's just assortment. How a single tetrad lines up. Independent assortment refers to the fact that how one tetrad assorts, either red up or blue up, has no effect on how the other tetrads assort. So in essence, each individual tetrad is flipping its own coin to determine whether red is up or blue is up. And therefore, since it's independent, it's not necessarily the case that all the reds will be up and all the blues will be down, or vice versa. It's on a per tetrad basis. And just like in this example, two of them happen to flip their coins so that red is going to go up and blue is going to go down. This other one flipped it the other way. It's going to go blue up and red down. And so that's why this is just by itself an additional source of genetic variation. Now, if there is an N of 1, which is possible, the simplest case, right, then independent assortment doesn't actually add any additional variation because it doesn't matter whether it's red up or blue up. Each cell is going to get the red one red one. I mean, one cell is going to get the red one, one's going to get the blue one. So that flipping of the coin with only one tetrad doesn't really matter. But if you have two or more, then there's multiple possibilities. You see what I'm saying statistically? And there's more and more possibilities the greater n is. Mathematically, the total number of possible ways that independent assortment can arrange tetrads. So this is due just to independent assortment. It has nothing to do with crossing over. That total number, though, is 2 raised to the n minus 1 power. So this is an n of 3. Therefore, there would be 4 possible ways that they can independently assort. Because it would be 2 to the 3 minus 1. 2 squared is 4. But for humans, n is 23. So it would be 2 raised to the 22nd power, which is millions. There's millions of ways that they can just line up. And millions is seems like a big number, and it is. But as big as that is, that's still effectively zero compared to the number of ways that they can cross over before that even happens. And therefore, that almost infinite number of crossing overs gets multiplied by millions to make it even more source of variation. And this is why I was saying it doesn't really matter that we make millions of sperm every day for many years. We're never going to produce the same two of the same sperm before we die. Not that it's totally impossible, it's just so improbable. You know, it'd be like hitting Powerball 2 weeks in a row. Actually, even less likely than that by far. Okay, so those are the two sources of variation that occur per parent during meiosis. While each parent is producing its own gametes, that means these sources of variation are producing totally different gametes each time. Now, I said that 4 cells are produced because there's 2 division events. That means 4 cells for this particular cell that started the process. But every time a cell goes into meiosis, 4 cells are produced, and those 4 are going to be totally different from any of the 4 from previous times. All right? Therefore, this huge number, this almost infinity times a millions, that really represents the size of one parent's deck of cards. And the other parent has the same size deck of cards, enormous. Random fertilization refers to the fact that when two parents get their gametes together for fertilization, it's a random draw of which gamete gets chosen from each parent. So you draw one card from an almost infinite deck for one parent, one card from an equally big deck from the other parent, and therefore the total number of possible zygotes that those two parents can produce is almost infinity times almost infinity. So that's why you don't see identical individuals produced unless they really start out as one individual and accidentally it splits. Identical twins, in other words. Yeah.
So, like, out of the 4 cells that are produced, are, like, only one of them used?
For a female, yes. Not for a male. For a male, all 4 are equally viable. Oh, you mean in fertilization? They all have an equal chance. There's only one that wins out per egg in humans, for instance. Animals in general. They're all trying, though. But in a female, she actually does it so that almost all of the cytoplasm is put into one of the 4 cells and the other are tiny and they just get destroyed. And that's actually what defines a female. It's not obvious in all species what the female is, but the female is the one that produces the bigger gamete. Which makes sense because in fertilization, the sperm is really just delivering its chromosomes. It's not adding any bulk to the cell. It's just giving it DNA. So in order to have highest chance of survival, the egg needs to be as big as possible, like a normal cell. So that's why she uses almost all of her cytoplasm for one of the four and then destroys the other three. Okay?
Is it within this process?
Well, the problem with incest is not that things are going to go wrong with this process. The problem is that it drastically increases the chance of having two versions, one from each parent, of a deleterious or bad for you gene. You know, there are different versions of genes that we'll talk about eventually called alleles. Some of them are normal, some of them cause problems. But a lot of the problems that are caused are only cause problems if you have both of your genes, one from each parent, be the bad version. Well, in a family, it's more likely that two parents are both going to have that same bad gene, and therefore it's much more likely that a child produced by those highly related people will have two versions of that bad gene. If instead, though, you mate with someone unrelated, it's less likely that they'll be carrying this bad thing that runs in your family. So the children that will be produced will have one bad one and one good one, and they won't have an effect necessarily because of that. That's the problem. Another thing I want to mention on this slide, even though it's not directly shown by these pictures, is that there are two major categories of cells in your body. And those are called, make some room, somatic cells and germline cells. Now, somatic, soma means body. And so somatic means of the body. It's kind of a misnomer because both of these cells are part of your body, obviously. But somatic cells vastly, vastly, vastly outnumber germline cells. You know, you're, like, as we've said, roughly 100 trillion cells make up what you call your body. Almost all of those are somatic cells. Germline cells, this tiny fraction of your cells, are found only in gonads. Gonads are primary sex organs. What makes something a primary sex organ is that it produces directly the gametes. So gonads is the unisex term. The two sexes have their own versions of gonads. So female gonads, the primary sex organs in females, humans, are the ovaries. In males, it's the testes. All right, those produce the gametes, egg and sperm. Well, not even every cell in gonads are germline cells, but that's the only in gonads do you find these germline cells, and it's a tiny, tiny fraction of your overall cells. Both of these categories of cells in humans are diploid. Remember, we talked about the sexual life cycles. We live our multicellular stage as diploid individuals, and both of these types of cells are diploid. So that's not what distinguishes them. Rather, they are distinguished by the kind of cell division they can undertake. Somatic cells, if they do divide, divide only by mitosis and cytokinesis. Germline cells, on the other hand, divide by mitosis and cytokinesis and meiosis and cytokinesis. And so this cell that we're looking at here is a germline cell. This original cell on the left is a germline cell. It's undergoing meiosis. Now, the purpose of your germline cells by going through meiosis is to produce your gametes. And the reason that you need meiosis to do that is because we are diploid. We need our gametes to be haploid so they can join with a haploid gamete from someone else in fertilization to produce a diploid of the next generation. But I just told you a minute ago that germline cells can undergo mitosis and meiosis. Why would you have both? Why not just meiosis, since that produces the haploid cells? Exactly. You already have a tiny population of these in your body. If they were only able to undergo meiosis, then every time that happened, the population would be one fewer cell, because that one no longer exists once it goes into meiosis, right? So you would run out of germline cells if you only had meiosis going on in them. Each time meiosis happened, you'd pick one of the remaining germline cells, and then you'd be left with fewer germline cells because of that. Because this cell here starting no longer exists once it goes into the process. Four cells replace it, but they're different cells. So instead, in this tiny population, whenever a cell's number comes up, so to speak, it will first go through mitosis, which does not change the ploidy, right? It just makes two exact copies of the original cell. One of those two cells will then go into meiosis and no longer exists as a germline cell that produces four gametes. The other copy stays behind and replaces the one that was lost. So that means you maintain this small population of germline cells rather than deplete that population. Does that all make sense? Okay, let's then go to 8. This is a side-by-side comparison of mitosis and meiosis, but first of all, keep in mind that mitosis does not require a diploid cell. A cell of any ploidy can enter mitosis because mitosis does not change the ploidy. Here, though, since meiosis does require a diploid cell, a diploid at least, we're just saying diploid in this, of course, then we're comparing it with a diploid cell in mitosis. Okay? What is the N here? On the left? Yes, there are three kinds of chromosomes. And it's a diploid cell, as you see, because there's two of each kind. Well, in mitosis, we don't use that word homologous chromosomes, right? So the two big ones don't care where they each other is. It's 2N different things lining up in a diploid cell at metaphase. Individual replicated chromosomes. But in meiosis, we do use the word homologous because the two homologs of each type come together. They synapse and they cross over. And you can't quite see crossing over probably from where you're sitting, but we'll get an even better picture of that in a minute. Okay, so that happens in prophase 1. Another big difference, of course, is that you don't have 1 and 2 in mitosis. You just have one division event. But in metaphase 1 of meiosis, it's not individual replicated chromosomes that line up. It's tetrads, synapsed pairs of homologous chromosomes. And then what splits in anaphase is not individual is not sister chromatids like it is in mitosis. It's homologs separating from each other and going to separate cells. That's where ploidy gets cut in half, because each cell is now going to have, each of these two cells produced by meiosis one is going to now have just one of each type, either the red one or the blue one of each type. Okay, so you recognize these as already being haploid? Is that making sense? But they're still replicated chromosomes, even though there's only one of each type in each cell. So you still need another round of division that's just like mitosis, where those replicated chromosomes line up and then sister chromatids split apart. Actually, the word sister chromatid doesn't really strictly apply here anymore because the two chromatids are not identical anymore because of crossing over. Notice this chromatid is all blue. This one's partly blue and partly red because of crossing over. So we can still call them sister chromatids, meaning that they're connected together. They're just not identical anymore. And that is one reason why all four of these cells that are produced are genetically different, and also because of independent assortment, they're genetically different. And of course, they're all different genetically from the parent cell, the original cell, because for one thing, they're haploid instead of diploid. But in mitosis, the two that are produced, only two because it's one division event, are genetically identical to each other, and they're genetically identical to the original cell. Not this cell, because this one is replicated, but to the original cell that this one developed into before replication, before it went through the S phase. Well, that's all explained more or less in words in slide 9, and I'm not going to read this table to you because we've gone through this, but it might be a good study aid for you, so I've included it in the slideshow. Anything that goes wrong in the entire process leading up to fertilization can be termed infertility. But yeah, that's just one example. Any part of the process can have mistakes being made. And if you have some insufficiency of germline cells, then that will, for instance, if it's happening in a man, he'll still produce semen. There just won't be very many sperm in the semen. It's mostly fluid. Okay, 10. 10 and 11 are the two last slides, I think. But unfortunately, they're switched with respect to the order in which they occur. I just want you to realize that. I gave the correct order in which these additional sources of variation that are occurring in meiosis before. First, it's crossing over. That's in prophase 1. And then independent assortment in metaphase 1, which is later. But independent assortment, the second to occur, is what's shown here first in slide 10. And this is for the simplest possibility that matters. Like I said before, if you have an N of 1, independent assortment doesn't really apply because there's only one tetrad, right? So it's not independent of any other tetrad if there's only one. But having an N of 2 is the simplest possibility. And remember, 2 to the N minus 1. Well, if N is 2, it's 2 to the 2 minus 1, 2 to the first power, 2 possibilities. The two possibilities are shown here. Either they can flip their coins so that both blues go one direction, both red go the other direction, or each cell gets one red and one blue. That's the only two possibilities. But for humans, there would be millions of possibilities because there's not two pairs, there's 23 pairs lining up independently. And the fact that two of these four cells are identical in this slide is kind of a lie, because this means in the previous stage, no crossing over had occurred, but actually a crossing over does occur. In other words, this slide just ignores the contribution to crossing over. This is just showing you what happens solely due to independent assortment. But in 9, we see what happens as a result of crossing over. This one happens to be crossing over twice. It could cross over once or twice or not at all. But there's so many possibilities that's what gives you such huge numbers I was talking about. And anyway, now that you have a close-up view, you can see what I was trying to draw before. Crossing over actually swaps the genetic material from the chiasma onward to the tip. And therefore, you get a chromatid within one homologue that is a mixture of both homologues, whereas the other chromatid is still all original. And that, along with independent assortment, means you're going to make an effectively, with a big N, you're going to make an effectively infinite number of gametes, and therefore never any identical offspring. All right, that's 1. chapter.